Welcome to The Final Word, a Bible teaching ministry with pastor, teacher, and author Jim Andrews. The Final Word is grounded on the invincible conviction that what the Bible teaches, God teaches, and that is the last word. On this program, truth still matters. The Bible is in, Babel is out. The Final Word is funded by listeners like you. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about the program, please go to our website at thefinalwordradio.com. There you'll find archives so you can listen to any program you may have missed. Visit us on Facebook at The Final Word Radio and write us a note. We love hearing from our listeners. We'll provide other contact information at the end of the program, so have your pen ready. And now, Jim Andrews continues his study of God's Word.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us again on The Final Word. Before I launch today's exposition, I want to make our listening audience aware of some articles that you might be interested in and tell you how to access them. If you will go to jimandrewsbooks.com, you will discover there are some articles that I produced over the years, so I'm just happy to share them with you for whatever benefit they may have. Now, back to our current study. We've arrived at Genesis 29. Jacob arrives in Paddan Aram, 600 miles away approximately from his home in Canaan. Then Jacob went on his journey, and he came to the land of the sons of the east. And he looked, and he saw a well in the field. And behold, three flocks of sheep were lying there beside it, for from that well they watered the flocks. Now the stone on the mouth of the well was large. When all the flocks were gathered there, they would then roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep and put the stone back in its place on the mouth of the well. And Jacob said to them, "My brothers, where are you from, friendly fellow?" They said, "We're from Haran." He said to them, "Do you know Laban, the son of Nahor?" They said, "We know him." He said to them, "Is it well with him?" They said, "It is. Behold, Rachel, his daughter, is coming with the sheep." We'll stop right there. So Jacob finally came to the land of the northeastern peoples in Mesopotamia, as I said, about 600 miles from home, a goodly amount of miles in any particular time, but especially a long way off in that day where travel was by foot or on the back of an animal. In verse 2, Moses, our narrator, sets up the providential, and I emphasize providential, circumstances that led Jacob right off to his wife-to-be and to his kin. This is the blessing of God. At the same time, we're about to see a side of Jacob, so far hidden from view in the narratives. In contrast with Esau, it might have seemed that Esau, of these two, was the man's man, and Jacob might have appeared to us as a soft, stay-around-the-house kind of man, what we'd call today a sort of mama's boy. That false image about Jacob's manhood is quickly laid to rest in this narrative. We see it in his first social encounter with a group of shepherds in the neighborhood of Haran. Moses emphasizes this point. He saw a well in the open country with three flocks of sheep lying near it, because the flocks were watered from that well, and the stone over the mouth of the well was large. Well, when all the flocks were gathered there, the shepherds, as was their habit, would roll that big stone away from the well's mouth and water the sheep. Then they had returned the stone to its place over the mouth of the well. Now, we should emphasize that wells were a valuable, may I say invaluable, commodity in the Near East. They still are. That is arid country. The wells had to be protected from contamination, for one thing. Then, too, a large stone over the mouth might discourage interlopers from misappropriating water, because it was no easy lift. Well, in verse 4, Jacob was interested in getting his geographical bearings, so he asked the nameless shepherds where they were from. Interestingly, he learned, and gratefully, I'm sure, that they were from nearby Haran. That was his destination. As I said, providentially convenient, for the invisible hand of God is in all of this. He's guiding Jacob. He is guarding Jacob, and he's going to provide for Jacob. Not because Jacob is at this point in his life a great man of God. I've said that over and over again. Jacob barely knew God at this point. He had had an encounter with God back at Bethel. So that has made a difference. But just in the spectrum of knowing God, well, he was not at the upper end. He's still at the lower end. He's a man who is in the process, by God's grace, of coming to know God. But so far, if Jacob has eyes to see, he's being providentially guided. Naturally, Jacob was curious to learn, hey, do you know my relatives? Do you know Laban, Nahor's grandson? Oh, yes, we know him, they answered. Then Jacob inquired about Laban's health. They affirmed that he was in good health. Then, as providence would have it, the shepherds who were gathered around the well said, and by the way, here comes his daughter Rachel with the sheep. We gather that she was approaching a little distance away with her sheep. In those days, women shepherded flocks as well as men. Well, you talk about a divine appointment. Folks, it's an illustration. When God is running things, things that are meant to come together get together. That was not just true in the case of Jacob and Rachel. This is true in our lives as well. Those of us who know God are honest disciples of the Lord Jesus Christ. Well, now in verse 7, the other side of Jacob's personality is now painted on Moses' canvas. Jacob does not care at this point too much for what he sees, and he's a man who knows the shepherding business. Let's read. Jacob, this is kind of gratuitous on his part, after making some general inquiries about his relatives, that sort of thing, he says in verse 7, and I'm going to paraphrase slightly, hey guys, it's high noon. It's not time for the livestock to be gathered. Water the sheep and go pasture them. Right there, as Moses paints the canvas of Jacob's natural leadership, God-given leadership, he's going to need it, leaps to the fore. Noontime was not the right time for flocks to be gathered. To Jacob, they all seemed to be messing around. So, as if he were the man in charge, he wasn't. It didn't make any difference to him. He was a total stranger. He was man enough and bold enough to command the shepherds to water the sheep and to take them back out to pasture. Oops, there was a problem. Verse 8. The shepherd said, well, sir, we cannot do that, I paraphrase. We've got to wait until all the flocks are gathered. That's when they roll the stone from the mouth of the well. Then we will water the sheep. Apparently, all the shepherds would have to gather there and wait for all the flocks to be present and accounted for. It just so happened that that big stone, I imagine it was a circular stone, but we don't know it, it doesn't matter, was covering the mouth of the well, and it was, as we might say today, a big mother. And it required some manpower, usually, to shift it around. So they had a habit. They would customarily gather the flocks around midday only, when the flocks and shepherds using that well were there, all of them together. Well, it turns out, as that conversation about the timing of the watering of the sheep was taking place, Rachel arrived on the spot with her father's sheep. We read in verse 9, and while Jacob was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. And it came about when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and saw the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, in other words, his uncle, Jacob went up, and he rolled the stone from the mouth of the well and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. And Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted his voice and wept. And Jacob told Rachel that he was a relative of her father, that he was Rebekah's son. And she took off, she ran and told her father. Well, as Jacob was having this conversation with the shepherds about this not being the customary time for the sheep to be watered, and having gotten an explanation that they all had to wait until that stone could be moved because it was kind of community work, so to speak. Well, here we see we're startled in verse 9. Jacob immediately springs into action. Some of it may have been adrenaline, but probably most of it was just a man of imposing strength. But I might add, I think men are always stronger in the presence of a beautiful woman. By himself, apparently, he removed the well cover and watered his uncle's sheep. He was in full protective mode. Jacob knew that a female shepherdess could get pushed around by rough male shepherds, who in the day had a low view of women anyway, and he was going to have none of it. He let it be known before anybody ever had a chance to contradict him. Well, in verses 11 and 12, we saw that Jacob immediately identified himself to Rachel and his relation to her. With great pent-up joy, he embraced her. Thereupon, she promptly left her flock, we assume in Jacob's capable hands, while she dashed home to deliver the great news to her father. Things were coming together. This is not Jacob's doing. This is God's doing. His invisible hand is behind all of the details, all the providential linkage. Well, in verse 13, Rachel's family is overjoyed. The news of the arrival of a relative from afar, that was great news. Laban rushed out to meet his nephew. They greet each other affectionately in the usual Oriental fashion with embraces and a kiss on both cheeks, still customary in that world even today. Then Laban escorts Jacob to his homestead. There Jacob related to his newfound uncle all these things that had brought them together. Was all in the providence of God. God who is guiding him. God who is guarding him. Well, Rachel's family, overjoyed by the news of the arrival of a relative from afar, Laban escorts Jacob to his homestead. Laban welcomes his nephew in verse 14 as one of the family. He pronounces Jacob, my own flesh and blood. Things were all very good at this point. They were all according to God's plan. Well, in verse 15 of chapter 29, after Jacob had stayed with the family for a month, Laban says to Jacob, look, I paraphrase, because you are my nephew, it doesn't seem right that you serve me for nothing. So let's negotiate. Tell me, what shall your wages be? After spending that time helping out his new family in Haran, helping out as he could and making himself useful, Laban wanted to find a more permanent arrangement for Jacob. He kind of liked the deal. He kind of liked the man. He thought he'd be very useful to him. So he professed not to want to take advantage of Jacob's relative status. What he really wanted to do, he said, was make him an employee of their sheep business. Generously, or so it seemed at the time, he asked Jacob, why don't you just name your wages? Actually, Laban had probably noticed Jacob was taken with Rachel. In what we will see again and again was his cunning fashion. Laban figured a way, which is very important, in the customs of the time to marry off both of his daughters. Both. Not just Rachel. He wanted to extract from Jacob an exceedingly long labor contract. One such as only love, great love, could tolerate. But Laban is not showing all of his cards at the moment. What we are about to see is Jacob running up against a crafty relative, one who will give Jacob a painful dose of his own deceitful nature. What we're seeing here, Jacob, Rebekah, Laban, the apple has not fallen too far from the family tree. And we're going to see that playing out. In his great grace, God is going to bless Jacob immensely. But at the same time, God is going to chasten, discipline, train Jacob severely. And in the end, he's going to change him to a much better man. All of this, folks, says grace often shows up wearing a funny face. Well, in verse 16, we read, now Laban had two daughters. The name of the older was Leah. The name of the younger was Rachel. Leah's eyes were weak, but Rachel was beautiful, of form and face. Now, Here's a key. Jacob loved Rachel. So when he bargains with Laban, he says, "Really, this is not hard to figure out. I'm not going to try to hijack you. I will serve you 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel." Laban said, "Oh, man, I'm good with that. It's better that I give her to you than I should give her to another man. So stay here with me." So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and his love for her was so great, the text tells us, that they seemed to him but a few days. So naming the price was not hard for Jacob. By the time this negotiation was taking place, he had fallen so deeply in love with Rachel, the younger of Laban's two daughters, that he was cool with it if he just got her. Love, as the saying goes, is a many splendid thing. But it can be pricey when those emotions override cool, calculated reason. At this point, Jacob had no brakes. He was all in. "Just give me that girl. That's all I want, Rachel. I will serve you 7 years for her." To prepare us for what comes next, Moses, our narrator, explains that Leah, quote, had weak eyes. Now, that description does not necessarily mean poor eyesight, does not necessarily mean even unattractive eyes. It could mean only that her eyes, many commentators think this, lacked that special sparkle and fiery quality that was prized by Near Eastern men in that day. And mentioning that Rachel had a lovely figure and was beautiful does not necessarily mean that Leah was, quote, a dog, end quote, by contrast. It may simply mean that Rachel's physical endowments were striking to the point of exceptional in terms of physical beauty. Well, in verse 18, Jacob pipes up and he gave Laban an offer that Laban couldn't refuse. No surprise to the cunning Laban. He knew he was taken with Rachel. So in exchange for 7 years of labor, Laban would give Jacob Rachel for his wife. So they quickly came to terms, but Laban deceitfully, oh, there it is again, deceitfully left out an important cultural detail. What did he leave out? Well, it was not proper to marry off a younger daughter before the older one. But the crafty Laban kept it all to himself, had a deceitful plan, and the plan would give Jacob a taste of his own medicine. You can just see Laban shaking on that deal and hear him saying, "Oh, much better to give her to you, son, than to some other dude off the street. I'm totally on board with this bargain, so just stay around the ranch with me. Work off your marriage price." Of course, Jacob would not actually get to marry her before the debt was paid. He'd have to wait 7 years to consummate the marriage. But we're told that his love for her was such that they seemed only a few days to him. Now, that was some love indeed. There's never any question about Jacob loving Rachel. Well, at the end of those 7 years, verse 21, Jacob approaches Laban, and his tone is a little bit demanding. We'll talk about that. Then Jacob said to Laban, he doesn't say please, "Give me my wife. My time is completed, that I may go into her." So at the end of 7 years, Jacob, in a rather demanding tone, tells Laban that he wants his wife. He had probably seen by now that Laban had every indication of drawing it out as long as possible, bleeding him for his labor. Not a day early, that's for sure. Jacob would indeed need to insist that the terms of the agreement be A, fulfilled, and B, quickly. "Give me my wife. My time is completed. So let's quit stalling around, Uncle." From the language, that seems to be the flavor of it. Jacob is starting to get it. This Uncle Laban is a cagey character. Again, the apple did not fall far from the tree. Well, in verses 22 through 25, Laban did the right thing. We see him make all the customary arrangements for the wedding feast of his daughter Rachel. However, when evening came, Laban had another trick up his sleeve. It was one that was going to cost Jacob, unbeknownst to him, 7 more years of his life. What Laban did was pull a bait and switch, assisted by the bride's customary veil. We read that when evening came, Laban took his daughter Leah. He brought her to Jacob, and Laban gave his servant, female servant, Zilpah, to his daughter as Leah's attendant. So when the newlyweds came together under the darkness in their bridal chamber, Jacob did not discover Laban's dirty trick until in the morning light he looks over at his bride. And shock of shocks, it was not Rachel. You wonder how that could happen. Well, I don't know, but I think one reason it could happen was because Leah, though she was not as beautiful in face and form and eyes as Rachel, who appeared to be exceptional, she wasn't that far out of the margins. I think even in the darkness, a man could have recognized that. Well, in verses 26 and 27, after Jacob gathers himself from his shock, he accosts his uncle, Laban. He demands an explanation. I paraphrase. What on earth is this that you have done to me? That was not the deal, sir. I served you for Rachel, didn't I? Now tell me why you've deceived me. He demands an explanation. What's going on here? It's more than something between Jacob and Laban. What we have going on here is God bringing Jacob's own big character flaw to haunt him and to teach him and to make it repelling to him. The Lord has chosen Jacob. The Lord loved Jacob. But the Lord disciplines and chastens, as we learn from Hebrews 12, every son whom he receives. He wants to make us partakers of his holiness. Jacob has a huge wart here in his character. All of this teaches us God is not an indulgent father, but a diligent father, a caring one. God always seeks to conform all whom he redeems into his own moral image. Laban calmly, but also callously, gives Jacob a lesson in Mesopotamian culture 101. He informs Jacob, in case you didn't know it, sir, it is not our custom here in Mesopotamia to give the younger daughter in marriage before the older one. He could have told him that years ago, but he withheld that information, and apparently Jacob in that time missed the memo. Of course, a righteous man, had Laban been one, would have explained all that to Jacob before contracting a marriage for Rachel. But Laban was not a righteous man. He was a conniving man, like Jacob, and he was looking out for his own interest, and he was using his nephew's cultural naivete against him. Oh, my, Jacob must have wondered, how can this be fixed? Oh, simple. What Laban tells him in verse 27 is straightforward. Complete the bridal week of this one, meaning Leah. We'll give you the other also for the service which you shall serve with me for another 7 years. Another 7 years of very hard and stressful work. Taking extreme advantage of Jacob's intense love for Rachel, Laban knew what he was dealing with. Unfeelingly, he virtually reduces Jacob to a bondservant. Why? Because he's crafty enough to know he can get away with it. He can get away with it because Jacob loves Rachel with all of his heart. But what we see here, all Jacob's chickens are coming home to roost in the disciplinary work of God. God is shaping a man. God is making the man into what God wants him to eventually be. God's shaping him into a great patriarch of the nation Israel. Well, folks, our time has expired. Thank you for joining us on The Final Word. We'll pick up there in our next study.
The Final Word is a listener-supported ministry. Should you want to partner with us or want other information about this program, please visit our website at thefinalwordradio.com. Our postal address is The Final Word, 4565 Carmen Drive, Lake Oswego, Oregon, 97035. Our email address is info@thefinalwordradio.com. And our phone number is 503-699-9840. If this program is ministered to you, tell a friend about it. We do solicit your prayers for God's hand upon this outreach.